The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
You are a role model for the rest of the media. You really do investigative reporting and informative interviews.
I absolutely love your show.
Chris, greetings from the bright lights of Cherry Hill.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome in. Good morning. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for, well, first she's sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle. And she's also sitting in for the great Eddie Caiazzo, who has been exceptional over the past couple of days, pinch hitting for Chris. So, Eddie, I'm representing for everybody that I've seen on Twitter, and I'm giving you a standing ovation over here. You've been fabulous.
Christine, thanks so much.
No, It's the truth. We all miss Chris. Everybody does. And I've seen it on Twitter. And Chris, if you're listening out there, come back. We miss you. By the way, I prepared a very short song to let everybody know how we feel about Chris. Can I sing it?
Sure.
Okay. It's to the tune of Air Supply. You know, we're all out of love. Okay. Stegall is our love, the best in the business when he's not around. The airwaves are empty. Stegall is our love in health and in sickness until he comes back. We're just gonna kill some time.
Oh.
And you know I'm not a songwriter.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Oh, thank you very much.
No, I can assure you, nobody misses Chris more than I do.
I know.
But no. I'm excited to work together today because, locally, they had that fiery debate last night in New Jersey. I'm like, okay.
This is great.
This is perfect. This is the perfect day for Christine to say, hey, I'm in.
We got, no, and you're absolutely right. That's what I love. I love talk radio. I love obviously all of the national stuff, but I really, and Linda Kearns, Linda, who's going to be one of our guests this morning, and I were talking about this a little while ago about the need for in-depth, well-researched, expert assisted conversation on local news. And there has been so much local news going on. And particularly today, we're going to be able to talk about our neighbors in, well, not even our neighbors in Jersey. We're all one big family in this listening audience.
Yeah,
so,
what is it, the Delaware Valley or sometimes the greater Philadelphia area?
Yeah, I'm sure the people in New Jersey love being called a part of the greater Philadelphia
area. For better or
area.
Worse, right?
Exactly. But no, and then we had the first Pennsylvania March for Life. I've got my friend Dan Partowiak coming in later in the show to talk about that and to talk about our governor, Emperor Tom Wolf's reaction to that. I have some thoughts on that as well. So there's a lot of local news. Plus, we have President Biden's I don't know if it's a disconnect. I don't know if it's lies. I don't know if it's hypocrisy. I don't know if it's just Jen Psaki unraveling. But earlier this month, during an interview with George Stephanopoulos, President Biden was pretty much unequivocal that his military advisors agreed that they should pull out, that there should be no residual military presence in Afghanistan. I watched that interview. He was asked the question, I got to give props to, and I hate doing it, but give props to George Stephanopoulos. He asked the question three different ways. And Biden sweated a little bit, and he kind of, you know, like Grandpa, as Chris calls him, yeah, dithered a little bit. But the bottom line was, he came out and he basically said, no, he said there was division. He got different opinions, but that overall everyone agreed that they needed to pull out. And so yesterday, during the hearings with General Milley and General McKenzie, Kenneth McKenzie, and Austin, there was no division in opinion. They were pretty uniform in saying, well, we told him, yo, stupid, keep 2,500 in. They didn't exactly put it that way, but he said, you know, it's – and also Milley came out and basically said it's – what did he call it? He called it a logistical success and a strategic error, or a strategic failure. I'm trying to figure out, Eddie, I don't know if you can help me with this. What's the difference between a logistical and strategic? Is he talking about the optics for the strategic end of it, and logistically the fact that they were able to evacuate – some people?
That's what has been their talking points since this all started, since the first images, sadly, of the people clinging to planes and then falling off. What they're claiming and what they're riding high on, and we should be too, is that they had the most successful airlift in history. That's it. That's all I got.
The most
successful airlift. I don't mean to laugh. It's not funny, but it's a very serious thing. But that's literally just being in the press, in the media, and seeing their messaging. Yes, they're looking at it as the most successful airlift in history.
And I suppose if you're just going by the numbers of people that were transported out, I guess you could say it was the largest airlift. I wouldn't call it most successful, because I have personal knowledge and keep getting texts from people who never made it onto planes, who are still there. I don't see how anyone could, with a straight face, call what just happened in Afghanistan anything but a rank humanitarian disaster. And I've actually been going back and forth with some immigration attorneys that I know who are Biden acolytes, zealots, and they refuse to acknowledge that what happened over there is a humanitarian disaster. They were very quick to criticize Donald Trump for everything and anything that happened on his watch. They are absolutely opposed to any kind of deep dive criticism on what happened in Afghanistan. And the hypocrisy of some of my colleagues in the immigration bar angers me to no end. But of course, it's political, and it's always been political. And what angers me is that when you layer politics on a humanitarian crisis, you lose sight of the true victims. When we talked about the Kurds, the same thing. I had conservatives who refused to criticize Donald Trump for abandoning our allies in Syria. And I don't care who's president. I really don't care. I look at it. I look at each incident as a discrete matter. And I don't care if you're a Republican, a conservative, a liberal, or a Democrat. If you've helped create a humanitarian crisis, own it. And this crisis is on Biden's hands. Watch. There's that great new song from Five for Fighting, Blood on Our Hands. I've heard it a couple of times. I don't think we're going to be hearing it on the radio. You can download it. It's a great song. I love Five for Fighting, by the way, anyway. But it angers me, people, when anyone tries to justify what was done in Afghanistan. It was not by any metric, a success. Okay, that's just my own personal opinion, but it happens to be shared by a lot of people. And again, you know, we're coming back, and then we have the Haitian crisis under President Biden, and there are people, and I will tell you, there are immigration attorneys and attorneys that I know, and Democrats and liberals, and more power to them, who are criticizing President Biden for what happened with the Haitian crisis from both sides of that crisis and that situation. But for some reason, there are too many people who are unwilling to criticize what happened in Afghanistan if they happen to have supported Joe Biden's administration, you know?
Oh, yeah. And I think it's what you said before about it, this not being political. That's it seems to be the tack that friends on the left have taken. Like if you look at, I guess, at my friends list, right, I try to stay off of Facebook as much as I can. But, you know, they're just like, oh, you care now about Afghanistan because Biden screwed it up.
Right.
But
right.
Like, but you don't care about anything else. I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. I said, it doesn't, me being a partisan, like, that doesn't make this any better.
That's right. And guess what? You and I are both, I mean, I think our politics are, I wouldn't say our politics are completely clear to the people who are listening. But, you know, if we're on this station and we're agreeing with each other, we're conservatives, okay? I mean, we're on the right. But I also like the fact that we can look in a clear-eyed manner at, as I said, at these catastrophic events and not put a political spin on every single thing. It annoys me. I do the same thing on Facebook. I have, oh gosh, I forget what happened. I was equally critical of Donald Trump and Joe Biden on my Facebook page. And still, there were people who blindly supported Donald Trump and refused to criticize him, all the while attacking Joe Biden. Vice versa, as I say, the opposite was happening with another group of people on another post where they refused to criticize Joe Biden. And I just said, you know what? I can't deal with this. Block, block, block. I was very Stalinistic that day.
It's 2021.
I did my own purge. I was, you know what? I'm not the government. I don't owe you a protection for your First Amendment rights. You are gone, people. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great and greatly missed Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's 990 AM. The Answer. We will be back. You see, I've got to catch a plane, won't buy a ticket. Cause it's hard to just stop when you're spinning around. It's a weird world. Every day, yeah, yeah. Ooh, baby, I love your way. Every day. Shadows grow so long. Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle. And here in studio with Eddie Caiazzo on Philadelphia's 990 AM. The Answer. I will be with you until the 9 o'clock hour. Like up to and including the 8 o'clock hour. That didn't sound right. I'm leaving at 9.
Yep. Mike Gallagher will be on after you are.
That's exactly.
It starts at 9.
That's right. Yeah, I'm not filling in for Mike Gallagher. So, although I love Mike Gallagher, I think he's great. I listen to him when I'm on my way to the Dunkin' Donuts in the morning. He's on at 9 o'clock, and if I'm listening to him while I'm actually in line at the Dunkin' Donuts, that means that I'm late to work because I'm not in my office. Eddie, it's really warm in this studio.
Yes, like, it is.
It's like really hot.
I'll see what I can do.
Thank you.
Got it.
I'm like a puddle right now. It's great too because I was waving at Eddie, just like waving through the window, and he came running in. He's just so fantastic. He's trying to make sure that everything is okay, and he's a he's really a one-man show here. And he came and asked me if everything was okay, and I was just waving. And the power that I have to summon him is just amazing. Anyway, we do have a great, great show today. In the 6:30 segment, we have Matt Rooney, my buddy Matt Rooney from Save Jersey. I cannot think of anyone other than my beloved friend Dan Cerucci, who has more of a bead on what's going on in the beautiful Garden State than Matt. And he and Dan did a great I guess it was like a Zoom it wasn't a Facebook Live, but it was a sort of after the debate last night, they did a post-mortem, and it was fantastic. And I posted that, I linked to that on my Facebook page, and I believe you can also find it at savejersey.com. So when we talk to Matt in a few minutes, I want to pick his prodigious brain and figure out what, if any, impact there was from the debate last night. I do know that there is apparently, the most recent poll shows, a double-digit lead on the part of the incumbent over Jack Cittarelli, which if you viewed the debate last night, and I'm not sure that many people did, a lot of people don't watch gubernatorial debates. I do. I'm a political nerd. I watch debates on pretty much everything. I watch school board meetings on YouTube now. So this gives you an idea of my social life. But it was an interesting debate. And so, you know, I'll put that aside for a minute because Matt's going to be able to inform us. As I said, also later in the show, we're going to have Dan Bartowiak because, I mean, I am so thrilled with what happened on Monday in Harrisburg at the Capitol. My column tomorrow in the Delco Times, if you happen to be in Delaware County, you can actually pick up a hard copy of it. If not, you can access it on my Facebook page, or you can go to www.delcotimes.com and click on my my column. My columns come out on Thursdays, and Sundays. Some weeks I really have to rack my brain and figure out what I'm going to write. This week, I had no problem whatsoever. I saw pictures of the Harrisburg March for Life. And it just, I looked at those pictures and my heart leapt in my chest. I was really overwhelmed. I wasn't anticipating the crowds that were there. I wished that I could have been there. I had to be in court, unfortunately. This has been a very busy court week for me. If I did not need to be in immigration court, I can promise you I would have been at the PA March for Life. And Eddie, I know I was listening to you earlier in the week, and I know that you talked about it. It was really impressive.
Yeah, the numbers, it's as you said, I thought, okay, this is going to be cool. They can start this. This will be a year they can build on, you know, like, oh, we'll have a great first outing and then next year's will be even bigger. But I don't know. This was, I mean, there were thousands of people on the Capitol steps, and I was surprised at the Republicans that were there to speak.
I was really happy. I was happy that there, as I was listening to you on Tuesday, yesterday, I guess it was, and you rightly pointed out that Republicans are generally, you know, they talk the big talk sometimes when you ask them directly these questions, but a lot of the time they'll deflect and they'll feel much more comfortable kind of like, well, okay.
Yeah, privately you'll have their comment, oh yeah, Ed, I can assure you I'm a pro-life candidate. I'm a pro-life politician. It's like, okay. And then publicly they say nothing when
right.
Pro-life issues actually take place in their backyard.
That's exactly, you know? I mean, you have the few like Kathy Rapp who is, you know, she's fearless, she's out there. But for the most part, I think a lot of the legislators, as you said, they know, as Bob Dylan would – I almost called him Bill Dylan. It's too early in the morning. What Bob Dylan said, you know, we You don't need to be a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. You don't need to be a Pennsylvania legislator to know which way the wind blows. They know that it's not popular to be pro-life, to be anti-abortion, particularly with this executive that we have right now. And yet they came out. And I think what happens, it was sort of like a symbiotic thing. Seeing that many people there gave them the courage that they needed to be able to come out and say, okay, these are my constituents. These people are coming out, putting their faces in the public eye, putting their bodies on the line. And I loved Dan pointed this out to me. If you looked at that crowd, the vast majority of the people there were women.
Yes.
They were women. Governor Wolf.
It doesn't matter if I march for life, but it does matter if a woman does.
It really does. Governor Wolf. Governor Wolf thinks he speaks for us, and he don't. Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle. I'm here in studio with Eddie Caiazzo. And I could not be more thrilled if I had an entire Stocks pound cake sitting in front of me right now that I could eat than I already am, because I've got my buddy Matt Rooney on the line from SaveJersey.com. Matt is my go-to person, well, he and Dan Cerucci, when I want to talk about anything and everything Jersey. And Jersey's in the news right now. What happens in Jersey does not stay in Jersey, particularly for those of us in the Delaware Valley. Last night there was a debate, and there was a debate between Governor Murphy. I'm looking at his picture right now. I just can't get beyond his teeth. It's just those teeth are so big and so white. And Jack Cittarelli, who is the Republican challenger. And without further ado, I want to welcome Matt in, and I want to talk to him about that fabulous debate last night. Hey, Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Imagine how many Stocks pound cakes Phil Murphy could eat with those teeth.
Oh, my God.
Probably two or three at a time.
I love the fact that you call him Governor Snaggletooth. He does. He looks. I'm looking at this picture, and I would just vote for Cittarelli just to get rid of that face. I mean, you know, to have to look at that for four more years. I got to tell you, Matt, from your last name, it appears that you have Irish blood in you, right?
Guilty, yes.
Okay. And I'm half Irish, and I'm half Italian, and I treasure and love both parts of my heritage. But looking at that debate last night, I just pretty much said, okay, I'm going completely with the Italian side for now. Because
my grandfather, who grew up in Philadelphia, made that decision many, many years ago when he married an Italian woman.
Well, there you go.
Probably because he was hungry. He needed to eat. So that's what the Irish guys did back then. They found Italian brides.
That's what my dad did with my mom.
This time around.
Yeah, yeah. No. I mean, and I was just looking, just from the optics, Matt. It was almost like, what was it, the Nixon-Kennedy debates, because Murphy was Nixon and Cittarelli was Kennedy. Just in terms of the optics, he just looked so much more poised, secure, well-dressed. And even if you just put them on mute and you didn't even listen to what they were saying, Murphy just looked so angry and so upset and so hysterical in some moments. And Cittarelli was measured. But as you said, I was listening to the Facebook Live or the Zoom that you and Dan were doing. He was poised, but not to the point of being hypnotized and like Grandpa Biden. You had to poke him to make sure that he was awake.
That's right. Jack Cittarelli came prepared. He came to play last night, as the old saying goes. But there was no doubt that he had a pulse, despite the fact that he was so calm, cool, and collected. The Nixon-Kennedy analogy is interesting because I wasn't around for it, but I always remember hearing and reading that folks that listened on the radio thought Nixon won. People who actually watched the debate on television thought it was Kennedy. I think no matter how you consume this debate, you thought Jack Cittarelli was the winner. The challenge for him And the challenge for any candidate in New Jersey that's the challenger is whether people watched. These debates, unfortunately, don't get a lot of coverage. So looking at someone that wants Chitterelli to win, the most I can hope is that debate has as much an audience as possible, and that the Chitterelli campaign and the RGA and all the other groups that are trying to defeat Phil Murphy are busily cutting clips this morning of all of Phil Murphy's many flubs, including that incredible exchange when he said he wasn't going to raise taxes in the next 4 years. Absolutely mathematically impossible, including the fact that he's currently working on a I can't count that high green energy plant right now, which is going to raise all ratepayers' bills when you go and you pay your electric bill, folks, by tens of thousands of dollars a year.
Yeah, and I think, excuse me, well, I mean, what about the ad where he basically comes out and says, if taxes are your issue, maybe you don't belong in New Jersey or something along those lines. I looked at that and I thought, really? That's a message that you're going to tell people, well, if you don't want to give me your money, don't come here. Just the guy is unbelievable.
That's not the first Goldman Sachs Democrat who's been governor of New Jersey to say something like that.
Yeah,
we got a similar comment out of John Corzine way back in 2009. I forget whether it was North or South Dakota, so my apologies in the off chance somebody from the Dakotas is listening to this morning. But Corzine's like, you don't like it? You want jobs? You can move out there in the middle of the Great Recession. So these are the types of limousine liberals which tend to win in New Jersey when we do get a Democrat governor. And I think it's one thing to see it in an ad or read about it in an online newspaper, but when you actually see it in a debate, it just sounds so ugly. And Phil did it with a scowl. And I know you pointed out, Christine, he seemed so angry last night. I don't know if maybe he was overcoached, that you need to come out and you need to try to score some points because our internal polling's a little closer than the public poll suggested this race is. But on that question, and also that bizarre exchange on January 6th, where he's screaming about people dying, which, again, not that it wasn't a serious thing, but the way he presented it, I mean, he basically wanted people to believe that Jack Chitterelli was wearing that Viking helmet and had a sword and was leading the charge. It had nothing to do with the darn thing.
Well, I'm so glad you said that. In the studio, we have three different television screens, and the one that's tuned into CNN, they just ran that now ubiquitous campaign commercial for Murphy, essentially nationalizing the gubernatorial race and tying Chitterelli to Trump, just basically marrying Chitterelli to Trump at every possible level, calling him a Trump surrogate, like a proxy, again, reinforcing the whole thing about January 6th and the whole thing about, you know, I stood with Trump. The exchange last night, and I did watch the debate, the exchange last night where he was basically guilt, some sort of guilt by association, saying, well, I saw you at rallies. You were standing next to a sign that said, stop the steal, this and that. And it just, it was so sophomoric. And it was, again, he looked hysterical. That one point where he was screaming, he basically said, this disqualifies you. This disqualifies you. I said, he's losing it. I said, it's like a menopausal woman and her estrogen replacement therapy hasn't kicked in yet, which is probably inappropriate to say, but still, it's crazy.
Well, I think by the rules of political correctness, since you are a woman, you're allowed to joke about that sort of thing. If I had made that joke, then Eddie would have needed to revoke my invitation for at least a few months. But I mean, that's what I'm saying. It seemed almost as if he overprepared. He came in being told that he had to score a knockout, which, assuming you believe the polls, which suggest he's ahead by somewhere between a couple points to several points. I don't know why that was his strategy. But I do think it came across as shrill, and I think anybody that watched that debate said, you know what, this guy has had to deal with some very serious things, and he's made, at the very least, highly questionable decisions at every turn. And when he brought up January 6th and said, "Assemblyman," referring to Citarelli, "people die," Jack was quick on his feet. He said, "Well, you know, what do you mean? Like the nursing homes?
I saw that.
We lost 8,000 people." Yeah. And I think that's really Christine Jack's challenge down the home stretch, with the notable exception of wonderful shows like this one. Just got to be honest, New York and Philly media do not always give adequate attention to New Jersey politics. We don't have our own media network. We don't really have our own media market. So ultimately, when you go and you talk to people about this, and I've had these conversations, there's a lot of people that don't know that Phil Murphy, back in March 2020, had his administration send out a directive saying, "Hey, nursing homes, you have to accept COVID-positive patients." Yeah. That's a decision which was even less reasonable back then, when everyone thought COVID was even more potent than it is, and everybody's coming back from the supermarket wiping down groceries.
You know,
that was a stupid decision.
You make a great point there. First of all, I want to make sure that everybody knows that this is Matt Rooney from SaveJersey.com. Go to SaveJersey.com for all things Jersey. It's a great source of information. And anyone who loves New Jersey, and I love New Jersey. I was not born there, but I was raised next door, spent my summers at the Jersey Shore, have friends who live in South Jersey, visit them often. I love Jersey. And so I have a deeply vested interest in her success. And what, you know, you made a great point, Matt, about the fact that you're sort of squeezed between the two giant media markets of Philadelphia and New York, neither of which
Ben
are...
Franklin, a great Philadelphian, once referred to New Jersey as a barrel tapped at both ends.
Well, but, you know, and that was a point that I had. I was thinking about that last night when I saw the moderators, Brian Taft from 6ABC and, I'm not going to remember her name, but the anchor from ABC7 up in New York. And then they had someone from Univision or Telemundo, whatever it was. And I kept saying to myself, I remember the old days of the New Jersey network with Kent Manahan. And, you know, you had your homegrown reporters and media persons. And it just seems that it's a shame that New Jersey doesn't, other than you and other than the print media that they have and some of the radio stations, there's no New Jersey-centric presence there. And I think that that's unfortunate. And I mean, I guess my question for you is, do you feel that Jersey gets the appropriate amount of coverage between the two giant media markets, Philly and New York?
Oh, absolutely not. You know, even though some of our friends, and I'm not pointing fingers here, think that it's just a few farms and a few cows over here and maybe a few strip malls, this is a state of over 9 million people. This is one of the largest states in the union. It's an economically potent state in the union with a lot going on over here, including our Jersey Shore summer tourism industry. You know, it's got unique problems. There's a lot of people living here. And in the past year and a half, we have undergone a uniquely horrible COVID experience with a governor who's responsible for 8,000 deaths coming out of nursing homes. We lost one out of every three small businesses in 2020. For anyone listening that learned math from the teachers union, I'm going to break that down. If you have three businesses, one of them that was here at the beginning of January 2020 was not here at the end of 2020 because of Phil Murphy's lockdown policies, which we all know have been completely debunked as an appropriate tool to address this pandemic. And you could just go down the list, the tax increases, the mismanagement, the fact that, you know, going to the NBC is basically like going and playing a real life version of Oregon Trail. You got to pack your axles and your bear meat if you want to survive. And then maybe you get home a year later. It's not working. And if we had a homegrown media network, then we might get appropriate coverage. And I think New Jersey would quickly shed its blue reputation. You know, our friends at the Washington Post like to say democracy dies in the dark. I don't know if it's dark in New Jersey, but it's in a constant state of information twilight. And that's not a good thing. So it's SaveJersey.com. We try to fill the gap. We've got some great friends like yourself and Mr. Stegall in Philadelphia who give us some airtime and try to get the word out about what's happening here. But, you know, we need more allies.
Yeah, I agree. And I, as you said, you know, daylight is the best disinfectant. Daylight is when the more you can't have too much information. You know, I don't know if it was Brandeis or I should know this. I don't know if it was Justice Brandeis or Justice Holmes who said that you don't censor people. The way to fight back at speech that you don't like is to have more speech, is to have a large and open public square, public market. And unfortunately, I've seen that in our market here in the greater Philadelphia area, particularly in the metropolis of Philadelphia, that there are outside of this great station, outside of some websites like Broad and Liberty. I'm going to give a plug for the Delco Times because regardless of how conservative I might be and how not conservative some of the editors might be and some of the readers might be there, they have never censored me. So outside of those particular sources, media sources, there really is a dearth of fair, open, balanced reporting, opinion, and it skews your view. So we've got, I'm looking at this column, which says that the most recent Monmouth poll says that Murphy maintains a double-digit lead. Now, people are going to read that and they're going to say, oh, all is lost. Why do we even bother to vote? We're not going to watch the debates. We're not going to care. But, you know, unfortunately, you've got this narrative going there that New Jersey's blue. It's going to get bluer. Just give it up. How did Chris Christie get elected?
Right. It's possible. I think that, and if you look at other blue states as well, Massachusetts, Maryland, it's hardly unheard of for states that vote blue in federal elections to elect Republican governors. And I think that's because even in a place like New Jersey, there is a consensus out there that when you want your money managed at home, maybe a Democrat's not the best person to do it. So, you know, it's kind of like dating someone your parents don't want you to date. You know, you may spend a term with a Phil Murphy, but then you quickly go back to someone that is better for you. Hopefully in this case, it's Jack Cittarelli, a CPA who can actually do math and cares about the numbers. So, you know, the Monmouth poll is an interesting point too, because if you look at the sample, it's definitely undercounting Republicans based upon recent turnout. But I know that's something that you always hear when people are criticizing polls. Bottom line is Monmouth has been right sometimes. It's been wrong a lot. There's some politicians right now on our side of the aisle who wouldn't be in office right now if the Monmouth poll was predictive. So you also have to keep in mind that unlike a normal gubernatorial race, there's been almost no public polling this year. When Chris Christie ran for governor in 2009, you can go look at Real Clear Politics if you want. There was a large body of polls. No one's polling this race for a few reasons. I think there's been changes in the polling industry. I think there's a lot of focus on Virginia. I think that there's this media narrative that, you know, Phil Murphy has no chance of losing. So we all know that when you only have one poll, the chance of there being an error in the average is much higher because you only have one data point to go off of.
Do you think that
we do have Republican polls that say it's within a statistical dead heat?
Well, do you think it's also that people have lost confidence in polling ever since in 2016 Hillary Clinton was a shoo-in for the presidential election and look what happened? I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who just say, I don't believe polls because people don't necessarily say what they believe, what they're going to do. They say what they think the pollster wants to hear.
And it's the media's fault because they're constantly presenting polls as facts. We know what polls properly conducted actually are. They're a snapshot based upon a sample. And a sample is really just an assumption. This is what we think based upon our research or our assumptions what turnout might look like. So here ultimately is what we think the result might be if the election was held today. That's one of the reasons that there's so many variations.
You know, one last comment about this. I'm looking again at CNN, and they're doing a big segment on the Virginia gubernatorial debate yesterday. Yesterday. And I'm wondering, why aren't they covering New Jersey? I understand, you know, Virginia is right outside of D.C. and, you know, all of the power brokers are in D.C. and what have you. But New Jersey is right next to New York, which is where, you know, the media empire. So why is there such a focus on Terry McAuliffe and Glenn Youngkin? And we're not getting any kind of national coverage for Jack Cittarelli and Phil Murphy.
I think you just supplied part of the answer, that a lot of the power brokers aren't just next to Virginia. A lot of the power brokers that work in D.C. or pull the levers in D.C. live in Northern Virginia. Mm. So it's literally their backyard. So that's always been the case to some degree, because we've got these funky odd-year elections here in New Jersey. We are always second fiddle to Virginia. Are you noticing a pattern, by the way? We have a little bit of a complex, but it is what it is. That's part of being New Jersey. But I also have to tell you, if a Republican had Phil Murphy's record and had these nursing home deaths and chronic misadministration of key government functions, tax increases, allegations of mishandling of sexual assault allegations in his administration. I mean, you would have Vox, Huffington Post, MSNBC camped out in New Jersey to try to highlight everything the Republican governor did wrong. They would treat that governor like they're treating Ron DeSantis right now.
Oh, yeah.
But candidly, the media has made a value judgment that Murphy's done a great job. So why are we going to poke the beehive?
Yeah, I mean, if you had a Republican president who left American citizens behind in Afghanistan, .. Anyway, Matt, it was a fantastic conversation. I love talking to you. Everybody go to SaveJersey.com. Matt, I know you will be back. I can't speak. It's too early. I know you will be back on this station very soon. Good luck. God bless New Jersey. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, my friend. Talk to you.
Bye. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer.
For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, love you, man. You're all we got in Philadelphia.
Hi, Chris. I love your show.
I love your show. And I have to say my wife, who's a Democrat, also loves your show.
Good morning, Chris. Always enjoy your show.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome in to the second hour of the Chris DeGaulle Show on Philadelphia's 990 AM The Answer. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris. I'm here with Eddie Caiazzo. We are doing a lot of local stuff today, which is what I love. I mean, I do adore doing the national stories. And I actually think I spend an inordinate amount of my time focusing on national stories. But there's been a lot going on in New Jersey and in Philadelphia and across this beautiful Keystone State. One of those things has to do with elections and audits and information. And I couldn't think of anyone who I respected more or who I thought had more to bring to a conversation than my friend Linda Kearns. Linda was in the last time that I hosted a couple of weeks ago, and she gave us some invaluable information that you wouldn't get anywhere else. And so I thought that it would be fantastic to have Linda on today to talk about Josh Shapiro's, our Attorney General's, most recent move against the people of Pennsylvania. Not all the people, just some of the people. So without further ado, Linda Kearns, my dear friend, are you on the line?
Good morning, Christine. Good morning, Eddie. I wish I was there in the studio with you.
No, you don't, because it's hot. The temperature, I don't know what happened with the thermostat, but, and I know it's not me. I mean, you know, I could make, again, I could make more jokes about menopause like I did with Matt Rooney, but then I'd be kicked off the air. But no, it's hot in this studio. Anyway, yes, we miss you. How are you?
I'm good. Well, I'm coming at you from scary Philadelphia, and I hate to say that because I absolutely love this city, but I can't believe every day what's happening. You know, I don't think it's any coincidence that when the U.S. Attorney Bill McSwain left office in the beginning of this year, the criminals took notice, and now we're hitting over 400 homicides already, and we're not even in October yet. And it is just a really scary place to live.
Yeah, but Linda, we're going to have that plastic bag ban as of October 1st. Don't you think that will make Philadelphia much more livable? I mean, yeah, 400 and some dead, but we won't have plastic clogging up the environment. I'm excited.
Yeah, I don't understand what the government here prioritizes. I think that the mayor should be on TV every single day, should have a press conference every day about what he's doing to keep us safe. Because if we're not safe, it doesn't matter whether we're using plastic bags, paper bags, or just carrying our groceries out of the store in our arms. So
where's his handpicked police? Where's his handpicked police commissioner? I mean, she is AWOL, missing in action. Where is she? Where's Danielle Outlaw?
Absolutely. And, you know, your listeners, you have a choice. There are elections this year. This year we have judicial elections. Judicial elections are incredibly important. And unfortunately, this is one of the lowest turnout years that we always have. People don't pay attention to judicial races, but we have a great slate of candidates on the Republican side led by Kevin Brobson for Supreme Court. And we need people to turn out. Sometimes you can't stop the cheating, but the more people that turn out, then the election can't be stolen because the margins are too wide. So it's really important this year for people to turn out, because what I said when I, as you know, I represented Trump in November 2020, and the judges essentially decided that election in Pennsylvania because they changed the rules at the last minute. So really, the people who voted for judges 3 years before that election are the ones who picked the president. So if you're interested in who becomes your leaders, well, this year's the first step. Vote in the election in November and vote for the Republican candidates for judge.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. People sort of ignore the races for judges, and judges have absolutely monumental impact on our lives. I was listening to Eddie earlier this week, and he mentioned your name. And, you know, of course, I did my little cheer when I was on my elliptical when he mentioned you, talking about how when the I forget who it was who had been saying that all of the challenges that the Trump team had raised across the country, and particularly in Pennsylvania, had been unsuccessful and thrown out. Eddie quite rightly noted that the challenge that you raised with respect to the convention center here in Philadelphia and observers of the vote was sustained in the Commonwealth Court, even though ultimately, I believe, when it went to the Supreme Court, I'm not sure. You can remind us what happened, but I know that you had a victory when you filed your request to have a clearer view of the voting.
Well, I didn't just want a clearer view. I wanted a view. The Philadelphia Commissioner's Office had set up in the convention center, and the people that we had in there, some of the action was going on well over 100 feet away. We could not see what was going on. And the Philadelphia Commissioner's Office used the excuse of COVID. We can't get too near anybody. COVID. Well, first of all of the workers, all of the election workers were standing shoulder to shoulder. So they were right next to each other. So I really think that, as we all know, COVID was just a big excuse. But our watchers, who we had every right to be in there, they could not see. So I filed a petition on election day in election court and challenged it. I lost on election day, but then appealed it to the Commonwealth Court and won. And actually got an order that said my people could be 6 feet from all of the action. So the judge was very clear in her order. Unfortunately, what the Philadelphia Commissioner's Office did was they shut down all of the counting. appealed that to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And when you appeal a Commonwealth Court order to the Supreme Court, it acts as a stay. So that means that the lower court order went back into effect, and then we weren't allowed to watch. And that brings us back to this, what you talked about in your introduction of me, which is that the Republican legislature is now seeking documents to look at what happened in the 2020 election. And the Democrats are not happy. They don't want to talk anymore about 2020. All they want to say is, excuse me, it was the most fair and transparent election in history. Huh. That's their party line. They're sticking to it. Josh Shapiro is sticking to it. That's all. They just keep repeating that, repeating that, repeating that. And I was there. Our people could not see what was going on. We could not watch them open those mail ballots. We could not watch them to make sure that the ballots were filled out correctly. We could not watch to see if there was actually affidavits of assistance with ballots that someone else helped you fill out. We could not see what happened to ballots that looked like that they were returned because the postman couldn't find the person. So there's a lot of things that nobody saw. It's all a big secret. And the Republican legislature wants to look at it. And that's the basis of their subpoena. And the Democrats don't want us to say it. And what's funny about the subpoena and what's going on in the news is Josh Shapiro and the Democrats are saying that the Republicans want private information. They're saying they're asking for lists of voters' names and addresses and voting history. Well, you can buy that list for $20 on the Department of State website. That the campaigns buy it all of the time for the mailing list. That's how they know and send their literature to, or who to send when people walk down the street and knock on your door. They know whose door to knock on because they know if you're a Republican or a Democrat, and if you vote in all elections or you only vote in presidential elections. That most of the information that they're requesting is already publicly available. So for them to yell about privacy, that it's completely disingenuous. And Josh Shapiro knows better. He's just talking the party line because he wants to run for governor, and God forbid if he's the governor, because, you know, he's just going to carry all these policies into the governorship. It'll be another Tom Wolf term, probably even worse.
Well, Linda, yeah, that's what I thought. First of all, when you had mentioned this to me before, I said, well, I mean, if this is already public information that's accessible, you know, anybody who wants to get this information can get this information. What's the legal basis for any kind of lawsuit filed by the Attorney General? Oh, there is no legal basis. There's a political basis. This is completely partisan. And that's all Josh Shapiro has been doing for the past couple of months. You know, he pops up every day with some it's as if he still thinks President Trump is President Trump, is still in office. There's an anti-Trump this and an anti-Trump that, and he's all for women's rights, and he's, you know, tweeting about the veto power, how important it is to have a governor who has the pen. And it's just so transparent what he's doing. But what angers me is that unfortunately, there are uneducated people, and I don't mean stupid people, but people who are not educated in the ways of, you know, the laws, the legislation, the processes, as you are with respect to election law, for example, that are going to fall hook, line, and sinker for this idea that our attorney general is trying to protect our rights and trying to, you know, what makes me nervous too is that some libertarians might fall for this, because there's this very strong streak among certain conservatives of not wanting their privacy to be invaded, not wanting their information to be disseminated, when you quite rightly explain that it's already out there. So, it's important to clarify that.
This is an intergovernmental subpoena. This is the legislative branch asking an agency, the Department of State, to provide information. And so no one is saying that the legislative branch is going to get this information and make it public themselves. Part of their subpoena, they did ask for the last four to match up with the voters, the last four digits of their Social Security number and then their driver's license number. And the reason that they asked for that in the subpoena is because they want to match. That's a way to match up if a ballot was requested, was the ballot voted, and to make sure that the voters are who they say they are. And Shapiro is making a big deal about this, like, well, that's private information. But remember, this is an intergovernmental subpoena. Nobody is saying that the legislature, when they get this information, they're going to publish it. And guess what? Intergovernmental agencies trade this type of information all of the time. Department of State hires outside vendors to review the voting history and voting list and do work on election matters. So people other than those in the elections division see this information, but Shapiro and the Democrats are acting like the Republican legislature is going to answer this and then just publicize it. And that's just not what is happening here. This happens all of the time, and they are just hiding behind this umbrella of privacy, trying to scare people, which I'm starting to notice is a real Democrat tactic. Everything's just a big scare.
Yeah.
If they scare you, then they can control you. And I'm really interested in what this audit is going to show, because again, I was there. We could not see what was going on. And I know because we were watching some of those drop boxes, and we had people with a video camera at some of the drop boxes in Philadelphia, not all of them. We didn't have the manpower. But when we were watching, we had video of people dropping off 1, 2, 3, 4 mail ballot envelopes at a time in those drop boxes. And that's it. Dropping off more than one is against the law. You're only allowed to handle your own ballot, and that's called ballot harvesting. So that raises the question, if someone was dropping off someone else's ballot, was there an affidavit of assistance with it? Because that's the only way that you're supposed to handle someone else's ballot, is if they physically can't do it. So that's why they're asking for these affidavits of assistance in this audit.
Linda, and, you're an expert in Pennsylvania, but I wanted to pick your brain for a second about what just happened in Arizona. Supposedly, you know, this is the way it's being reported and played in the media. The audit in Arizona indicated that Joe Biden actually got more votes than they anticipated. Do you think, first of all, you know, what's your opinion on the authenticity of that determination? Is it being skewed in some way? And also, do you think that that's a possibility in Pennsylvania? Would that show that there was actually a wider margin for Joe Biden, or really that there was some misconduct? And I believe that there was definite misconduct in, at the very least, in the city of Philadelphia with the voting tallies. I mean, what impact do you think that the results of the Arizona audit will have on the Pennsylvania process?
Well, before you even get to tallying the votes, you have to look at were the votes cast correctly. And a huge issue in Pennsylvania was that the outside of the ballot, for anyone who voted on the mail-in ballot, said that had a line on it where you were supposed to sign it, date it, and fill out your address. And if you did not do that, then the ballot was not supposed to be counted, because when the legislature, who basically created this problem by allowing these mail-in ballots, when they decided in their wisdom that we were going to have this mail-in balloting in Pennsylvania, what they were trying to do by telling you that you needed to fill out your ballot, put it in a white secrecy envelope, put that white secrecy envelope into the mail ballot envelope, and sit down and fill out the outside of the envelope with your name, your address, sign it, and date it. They were trying to recreate basically what happens in the polling place. When you walk in, you say your name, you sign your name, you go behind a secret screen. So the problem in Pennsylvania is a lot of people were not filling out those ballots correctly. And so that we can't be sure of their authenticity. We can't be sure if the voter whose name was on the ballot actually voted it. And the one way that we could actually try to check, which is making sure the voter signed it, dated it, filled it out, they by not being able to watch and make sure that all those ballots were done correctly, we can't be sure that the election was as secure as everybody says it was. So before we even get to the voting, I'm really interested to see if the number of ballots, envelopes that were filled out correctly matches what they reported, because the only one who knows whether they were filled out correctly is the election people, because they couldn't let us watch. And one thing that happened in Pennsylvania, which still breaks my heart to this day, is even though they were not supposed to start processing the ballots until election day, in certain counties, they started looking at them ahead of time, and they were actually contacting voters and saying,
right,
hey, you didn't fill out your envelope correctly.
Right.
And the problem is they did not, not every county did that.
Right.
So depending on where you voted, you might have had the chance to correct your ballot. And that is just not fair. And
how's that not an equal protection challenge? How is that? I mean, yeah, similarly situated voters were treated differently. And I mean,
and we did challenge it. But the problem is, Christine, is that our election laws are designed to prevent fraud, not detect it after the fact. And so what this audit or any audit or the Arizona audit, nothing is going to change what happened. Biden is the president. He's going to be the president until he leaves office. So none of these audits are going to change that. What these audits are going to do is they're going to tell us if the laws were followed correctly. They're also going to tell us, okay, well, if they weren't followed correctly, why? And how can we change the procedures for next time to make sure they all are followed correctly?
I think that's important. I'm so sorry. We're up against the clock, but I mean, you will be on again and again and again, because this is an issue that will continue to return. And I think you're absolutely right. It's not necessarily was fraud committed in this particular election. It's what are the processes? What were the unconstitutional processes employed in this particular election? Linda, you're fabulous. We're so lucky to have you in the Philadelphia area in the greater the state of Pennsylvania. And I'm honored to have you as a good friend. That was Linda Kearns. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's 990 AM The Answer. We will be back.
More of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle. Well, we come to a segment that I think for many of you in the listening audience is your favorite part of the week. And that's our visit with the great Emerald Robinson, Newsmax TV's White House correspondent. I've already said this, I'm a girl fan. But I think one of the reasons that we all appreciate Emerald is that she asks questions that would normally not be asked in the press room of press secretary, Jen Psaki. So I think that I would like, first of all, to welcome in Emerald. Good morning. And I know that you are limited in time, so I'm going to hand this completely over to you. I would love to know what the mood was in the room yesterday when Jen Psaki had to handle those volleys of questions about whether or not President Biden was telling the truth when he said, yes, there were some military advisors who told him that pulling out from Afghanistan was a great idea.
Good morning. It's good to talk to you. Good to be with you. Look, there were a lot of reporters who pointed out, you know, not maybe overtly in their work, but we're talking about how shaken she was yesterday. Jen doesn't necessarily, look, she doesn't have an easy job, and I'll tell you why. And a lot of people would probably be surprised to hear me defending her, but she has a very tough job in that she doesn't get to talk to President Biden very much, not like in a normal situation, a press secretary would have much more access to the president and be able to speak for him. She doesn't get that. So in a lot of ways, she's up there flying blind. And yesterday was a particularly bad day in that the generals on the Hill, the top generals, General Milley, McKenzie, and Austin, had testified that they had advised President Biden to keep a contingency of 2,500 troops on the ground, at least, you know, to evacuate people and kind of do a slower drawdown. Biden, President Biden, has said on several occasions, including with in a television interview with George Stephanopoulos, that he would not advise that. And then Jen Psaki had to be the one, not President Biden, but Jen Psaki had to be the one to answer for it yesterday. And she was very nervous about it. You could tell. She always has tactics to counter, even if she doesn't have answers, which she normally doesn't. And often she doesn't tell the truth, or she, you know, she misrepresents something. But her, she wasn't as confident with her tactics yesterday, and it was clear.
You make a great point, Emerald, I think, and you know, you've actually inspired a little bit of sympathy on my part for Jen Psaki, which is, you're a miracle worker in being able to do that. But I think you're right. It does seem as if there's a wall between you know, Jen Psaki and the West Wing, that they're not communicating with the person who is supposed to be representing and bringing their message to the press corps. Do you know why that is? I mean, it is unusual. It's unprecedented for a press secretary to be so separated from the person she's representing, she or he's representing.
You know, it's interesting. Sean Spicer, who, you know, was the first press secretary under Donald Trump, and is my colleague at Newsmax and actually has the office right beside of me. We were talking about that yesterday, and it just, he is flabbergasted by it. He just cannot believe it because of the kind of, you know, relationship he had with Donald Trump and all of Trump's press secretaries had just ready access, constant access to the president. And he said he just doesn't understand how she does it. Look, Christine, there are very few people have access to President Biden. That is a major complaint in the West Wing. Top aides who, under any normal presidency, could go to the Oval Office, talk to the secretary, and probably get to go right in to see the president, can't get in to see him. And they're very frustrated because they feel like with their portfolios, they should have near instant access to him to make sure, you know, they're on the same page and that they're doing what, you know, the president wants them to do. Because ultimately, as he often says, the buck is supposed to stop with him. So this is the situation in the Biden White House where there are just a handful of people who really have access to him.
Yeah, it does seem as if they really are wrapping him in, you know, in bubble wrap and making sure that it's you know, he's very taken care of, very scripted. And then when he either goes off script or he's saying something authentic with another reporter like George Stephanopoulos, what have you, then they have to do triage because they have to basically unmessage what he's just put out there. And again, I mean, I am so grateful for people like you, for Peter Ducey, for Terry Moran, who asked the hard questions yesterday, for people who actually do the jobs that they're paid to do. I mean, you're there, you're our voices. You're the people who are trying to get answers for us. And it's obviously becoming a much more difficult endeavor in this particular era, the Biden era. But I know you are rushing off to the White House. I'm just so glad to have an opportunity to talk to you. And I know that the people in the listening audience are so grateful for Ms. Robinson every week. So, Emerald, the next time I'm on, I hope I'm on when it intersects with one of your segments. And Godspeed and good luck at the White House. I hope you get some answers today.
I hope so, too. You know, I'm going to be in there again today, and I'm going to try. I don't know if you saw on Monday, I tried to ask Jen Psaki a question. The moment she got to me, she tried to say the AP reporter, you know, the AP, the Associated Press reporter, told her it was time to end. But she looked right at me, and she decided she was going to end that briefing while I was saying Jen, and I was the next natural person to be called on. She called on the person beside me. And then she snapped at me and said, Emerald, why don't we do this during the normal briefing the next time instead of yelling at the end? I said, I'd be happy to if you call on me. So
it's fantastic.
I love
your exchanges. Well, you should be proud, Emerald. She looked straight at you. She knew you. She was going to get some tough questions, and she just said, "Never mind, move on." Anyway, take care. It's always great talking to you. Bye-bye. Have a great morning. That was the great Emerald Robinson, Newsmax White House correspondent. And we are going to take a quick break. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for another great one, the great Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless the priest, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey.
Drive home with me, Sebastian Gorka, this afternoon at 3 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Here's Chris DeGaulle.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle. In the 8 o'clock segment, we're going to welcome Rachel Lee, who is Director of Northeast Communications for the RNC, and we're going to circle back, as Jen would say, to a discussion about Phil Murphy and Jack Cittirelli.
I'll circle back if there's more I can share with you, but I'll circle back with you if there's more to convey. I'll have to just circle back with you. We can circle back. I'm happy to circle back with you. I can circle back. I will have to circle back on that one. That's an excellent question.
Oh, such an important question.
We will circle back with you, and we'll circle back with you. It's an interesting question, but we'll circle back. I'm happy to circle back, but I'll have to circle back with you on it. It's a good question, but we'll circle back with you on this today. We will certainly circle back with you more directly. I hate to disappoint you, but I will have to circle back with you on that as well.
Oh, my Lord. I have never heard one person use one phrase more. I mean, the only thing I can think of is Jimmy J. Walker from Good Times from the 1970s goes, dynamite! It's the only other situation where someone used to use, circle back, circle back, circle back. There's a great song way before your time, Eddie, although I know you're eclectic in your musical taste, called The Circle Game, which I love. It's a great, great song. I remember the version done by Buffy St. Marie, but I think either Joni Mitchell or Judy, what's her name? Judy, the famous one.
Oh, Garland?
No. Oh, God. The other one. She was the girlfriend of Stephen Stills. Judy Collins. Judy Collins. I couldn't think of her name. Anyway, it's a great, great old song. And now I can't enjoy the song because every time I hear The Circle Game, it's on my Spotify podcast, you know, thing. I keep hearing Jen Psaki, circle back, circle back, circle game, circle back. Anyway, real quick, a little bit of weather over here, because the last time that I read the weather, there was a bit of a typo. You might have heard at the end of my voice went up when I said 89. No. This is the correct weather. Today, it's going to be mostly sunny with a high of 70. Absolutely gorgeous. Tonight, it's going to be partly cloudy with a low of 53. And tomorrow, it's going to be mostly sunny with a high of 60. Nine. Those of you out there who heard 89 and wanted to strangle me and or yourselves, fear not. It is going to be beautiful, crisp fall weather tomorrow. It's going to be 69. Anyway, I wasn't going to talk about this particular topic, but since I have a little bit of time, I wanted to address it. You all know I'm an immigration lawyer. Most of you know I'm an immigration lawyer. And obviously I have views on humanitarian crises, including what happens at the border on a regular basis with Haiti, obviously the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. I've been doing this work for over 25 years. And again, as my good pal Eddie and I discussed early in the show, these are issues that should not have a partisan political gloss on them. That being said, I also happen to have a good deal of respect for the government and the job that career government officials are trying to do. I'm not talking about administrations. I'm not talking about Biden or Trump or Obama or Bush or Clinton, who are all the presidents that I have practiced immigration law under. And I will tell you, not one has been better than another. There have been a few that have done things that I really liked. There have been a few that have done things that have disgusted me at a personal level. But overall, I can say in my 25 years, there has been no president that has done the job that he should have done to both protect the United States and honor our tradition as a haven for immigrants. Okay, that being said, I'm not talking about those guys. I'm talking about people like ICE agents. I'm talking about people like Border Patrol. I'm talking about people who, regardless of the administration that they are serving under, are doing a very difficult job. About a week ago, a photo appeared, which appeared to show a Border Patrol agent on horseback whipping Haitian immigrants. A picture is only worth 1,000 words when those words are not lies. That photo was misrepresented in the media over and over and over again as a Border Patrol agent whipping an immigrant of color. Maxine Waters came out and described it as something worse than slavery, which I am sure would be news to her great-great-grandparents who were very likely slaves. There was the Reverend Al Sharpton, who hasn't taken an interest in the plight of Latino immigrants at the border, the people coming in from Central America and Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, the people that I deal with every day. He wasn't interested in them. But when it looked as if there was some kind of controversy that he could exploit with respect to Haitians, people of color, immigrants of color, by the way, Central Americans are also immigrants of color. But when he saw an opportunity to put his face out there and pretend that he was doing something and truly caring about black immigrants, he was on it. He was on it like white on rice. And yet, it was a lie. That Border Patrol agent was using the reins of his horse to stop the horse from stomping on that immigrant that was in the photo. But it didn't make any difference because that false narrative was out there. And you know who perpetrated and perpetuated that false narrative? None other than Joe Biden, who gets up there on the biggest bully pulpit in the universe and says, "We will make these people pay." Meaning that we, me, Joe Biden, will do the PC appropriate thing and throw the people that work for me under the bus, the people that are doing possibly the most difficult job currently in the United States, patrolling the southern border. I know what they're doing. I, quite like our president, have never been to the border. But I deal with people who have been transferred up from the border to Philadelphia and to other spots in the Northeast. I know what the conditions are like down there. I deal with people who have been detained in detention centers down there. And it is extremely difficult for the Border Patrol agents to do their job. They are underpaid, they are understaffed, and for Joe Biden to get up there and basically put a target on their backs is despicable, is wrong. And it would be wrong if it were Donald Trump doing it. Lord knows I criticized President Trump for things that he did. Equal time for President Biden.
more of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers on Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer. So we only have a couple minutes before the break, but I just wanted to read you an exchange that I had with a reader. I had written a column on Sunday about why feminism is a farce. Yeah, that was the title. You can imagine that I got some interesting responses, and this was one that I thought this was one of the more polite ones. This is one that I can actually read on air. It says, "Oh, Christine, you are so young compared to me anyway. So I may forgive your arrogance when you dismiss feminism. You listen to some online loudmouths and condemn us all. You weren't looking for a job as a college graduate being told by companies that, quote, we don't hire women, end quote, for fill in the blank. You weren't watching married couples being denied contraception because it was illegal. Try to open your mind just enough to let in some sunlight." And that was actually one of the more polite emails that I got. So my response was much more polite than my responses normally are. This was my response. Oh, it was, by the way, it was from Linda. Not our Linda, not Linda Kearns. It was a totally different Linda. No. It was a totally different Linda. Linda would not have written that letter to me. Okay. "Hi, Linda. I'm not that young, but I thank you for what I take, or whether you meant it or not, as a compliment and as an attempt to empathize with me. Here's where I'm coming from. Any movement that tries to find power in victimization is not a movement of value. I am 60. Okay, I'm not 60. I'll be 60 in December, but I kind of jumped the gun there. I have had older women tell me that I never suffered as they did, how unfair life was. But you know who never said those things to me, Linda? My mother, widowed at 42 and forced to raise 5 kids alone, never remarried. My grandmother, forced to leave school in the 3rd grade to support her family, then having to comfort her own mother when her father hung himself in the basement. The nuns, who were fierce, fearless, and brilliant, and who taught me that there was strength in humility. So, Linda, we will disagree about feminism and feminists. They have nothing to teach me. I've learned all I need to know from Better Women. Take care, Christine." Linda has not responded. But I just... You know, to me, being a strong, independent woman, having a strong and independent voice should not be conflated with being a feminist. I know a lot of women, including a young woman who just walked into the studio, Victoria, who I admire a very great deal. I don't know if she would consider herself a feminist. I would just call her a strong-minded, independent woman. And what I get angry about is that we get saddled with that label of being a feminist, and it has a lot of unfortunate baggage that comes with it. I think we should just call women, women, independent women. And that's it, folks. We're going to take a break, and we will be back.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hi there, Chris. You are better every day, starting from a very high standard. You are just on fire every day.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much for everything you do for us to keep us informed.
Good morning, Chris. Love your show, pal.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle. It's the final hour of the show. It's a really good thing that we don't have cameras in the studio, because when Eddie plays that real, you know, boppy music, I'm dancing back and forth. I'm actually sitting in my chair going, I look like one of those Charlie Brown characters, you know, when they have the little party, the Charlie Brown party with Pigpen and everybody. And I'm like, da, 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 because I got my ponytail going and it's back and forth. Anyway, I really am an adult, people. So, but when I come into the studio, it's just like the years melt away and I have so much fun. It's so great to be here. I can see Victoria on the other side of the window. Hey, Victoria.
Hi, Christine.
It's so good to see you. I haven't seen you in a while. So I am very happy to have as a guest in this segment Rachel Lee, who is the director of Northeast Communications for the RNC. And one of the reasons that I'm so happy to have her here is because if you remember earlier in the show, I had Matt Rooney on from SaveJersey.com, and we were talking about the gubernatorial race in New Jersey last night. And I was wondering why there wasn't more national attention being given to that, whereas there was a lot of national attention being given to the gubernatorial debate in Virginia. And so, welcome, Rachel. I'm really glad to invite you on to the show. And I guess my first question would be, do you have any opinion on the what I think is a disparate amount of attention in the media being given to the New Jersey race with respect to the Virginia race? And if so, why is that?
Good morning, Christine. Well, you know, I think what we are seeing, and you've observed a good point here, is that the media is afraid of all of the egregious policy failures that we've seen from Phil Murphy. And, I mean, the only really look across the country, most comparable to Cuomo. And they didn't want to cover him either until they absolutely had to, right?
Very true.
And so I think Democrats are scared that if the media actually starts covering Phil Murphy, not just New Jersey, because Jersey already knows this, but the entire country will realize that he's completely failed. You know, we had a third of businesses closed, small businesses closed, on his watch last year.
Very
a third.
True.
Yeah. We had, you know, 8,000 seniors die in nursing homes. And he was worried about that. And he made those policy choices anyways. And the list goes on. So I think that the media knows that the cards are stacked against him on his own watch. And so, of course, they don't want that getting out.
That's a brilliant point. I think, and you're right, too, about Cuomo. Until they were absolutely forced by some in the media, including Janice Dean and, you know, some Republican operatives as well, and the people of New York, until they were actually forced to do that, the grieving children of parents in nursing homes and what have you, they pretty much either ignored or they burnished the image of Andrew Cuomo. His book came out. There was a book that he published that was supposedly going to be a bestseller. And boy, did that bomb when, you know, the perfect storm of the sex harassment scandal and the nursing home scandal sort of coalesced to cause a problem. But I guess my question for you would be, what is the RNC doing to amplify the message of Jack Cittarelli? He's such a strong, good, solid candidate for New Jersey. And as you well know, New Jersey is a blue state. I mean, it is one of the bluest states in the nation. So what are you guys doing to sort of give a push, support, amplify the voice of Jack Cittarelli so that the people of New Jersey know what so many of us already know, that he really should be the next governor?
That's exactly right. Well, and as you pointed out, so much is on the line here. And so, you know, we obviously are very focused on races up and down the ballot. And I think that, again, that's something that Democrats really do not have the ability to compete with us on. And so we have our team on the ground working hand in glove with the New Jersey GOP. Fantastic partners. Absolutely love working with those folks. Love working alongside the campaign. We are all out there on the same page, on the same message. And so last night, our fantastic rapid response team was pushing out information and making sure that those clips and what you were seeing on the debate stage was being pushed out across the nation. And we have our folks and, of course, on our communications team as far as, you know, our national team, my job, everyone is working together to be sure that we're putting this, not just local reporters who truly, I believe, get the message out so well, and that's who people are turning to. They're turning to radio. They're turning to their trusted papers. You know, Matt Rooney, others who are out there every day getting out the message, that's who we're working directly with. But we're also working hand in glove again with the campaign and with the state party, because it's so important that we all work together here. Because to your point, this race is critical. Jack Cittarelli is the one for the job. Bill Murphy needs to be one and done. And on November 2nd, we're all going to be there together. I was at the debate last night, thrilled to see the energy on the ground. And I think you're going to see some exciting things over the next few weeks as we all work together and just run towards the finish line, because that's absolutely, we have the momentum, we have the excitement, everybody is on our side. It's not, you know, I think sometimes people look at policies and don't realize how they directly relate to their lives. But that's just not true in New Jersey. We see exactly how Phil Murphy policies have related to people's lives. In fact, you know, and I'm going to bring it up, I think that it's worth bringing up numerous times because he certainly didn't bring it up. But 8,000 seniors died on his watch. And last night, he stood there for an hour and absolutely no answer for that. In fact, he said that if he could trade places with any state in America, he wouldn't. He'd still choose New Jersey's response for COVID-19. And I think that says all.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I watched the debate and he completely deflected any responsibility for those deaths. I think New Jersey suffered the highest number of casualties, of nursing home casualties, even more than New York. I'm not sure if it was, you know, based on the percentage of the population, but it was horrific the way that not only did he deflect or abdicate any responsibility for that, he then pointed the finger at Jack Cittarelli for being responsible for the so-called coup d'etat on January 6th. And, you know, almost implying that Cittarelli was responsible for the deaths of some of the, you know, the Capitol police officers. It was just, I looked at that and I thought, if this is the way that he's going to conduct his campaign, this man is going to lose if there is honest reporting out there, if there are honest media outlets and sources that are going to accurately report what he's doing and what he's saying. Because it was astounding, Rachel, how he was trying to both deflect responsibility from his, you know, malfeasance in office and point the finger at Jack Cittarelli for killing people. It's just astounding to me. I don't know if you had that same impression, but it really struck me. And he also seemed very histrionic and hysterical last night, Murphy.
Oh, absolutely. And you could tell as he continued to just kind of unravel on stage, you could tell that one who is used to not having to be accountable for absolutely anything. And he did not walk on that stage last night with any plan to do so, with any plan to be honest, with any plan to take ownership over his many failures. And so, you know, just like you were saying, he would point over to Jack like it was something he had done. I'm sorry, sir, you have been in office for 4 years. It is time for you to own up to not just your mistakes, your absolute failure. And he did that turn after turn, continued to try to change the conversation. He did not take ownership over any of his failures. And that's not leadership, Christine. You know, that's not something that we can afford anymore. I don't think he expected to have to answer those questions. He certainly didn't really answer the questions, but I think he just came on with an air of arrogance that he wasn't going to even have to be asked. So,
agree. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I will say, he also, you know, he didn't even talk about the small business closures. That didn't even come up. He didn't discuss that. And so instead, they're talking about a lot of different, you know, hypothetical, would you enact this? Would you do that? And he's pointing fingers here and there. And yet, at the end of the day, we're seeing unemployment rates in New Jersey that are just nearly unparalleled across the country. And that's something that he needs to answer for. It's at 7.2%. It's tied for the fourth worst in the nation. I mean, that's a direct result of his policies.
Yeah. And his response is, we're going to raise taxes. And his very snide, snarky comment in one of, I'm sure you've seen it, one of the campaign ads is, well, if you're not interested in taxes, or if you don't like taxes, then New Jersey's not the state for you. I mean, who said, as Jack Citarelli said in his campaign ad, who says that kind of a thing? Who tells people, if you don't want to give me your money, you don't belong here? I want to pivot just for a second to the Virginia race, because that is the other high-profile race that I've been following. And can you talk a little bit about the Republican challenger, Glenn Youngkin? It seems like he's really nipping at the heels of Terry McAuliffe. From up here, you know, obviously we're not in the media market that focuses on that particular race, but from your view of it, your perspective, what do you think's going to happen in Virginia, or what do you think's happening in Virginia?
You know, I'm glad you bring this up, and I think that it's important for everyone nationwide to be paying attention to what we're seeing in both of these races. And right now, at the pivotal moment when it counts, momentum is on our side. And I think that people are energized about the policy proposals that they're seeing from Glenn Youngkin. And, you know, that's because he is a real Republican who is out there ready to fight for those who have lost their jobs. You know, he is ready to stop the mandate, stop what we're seeing overarchingly nationwide from Democrats who continue to have these ridiculous power grabs, trying to expand the government, trying to increase their own power, and trying to take over individuals' lives. I mean, last night we saw on the debate stage in Virginia a question about how involved parents should get to be with their children's education, saying that parents should not get to choose or have a say in what's going on in the classroom. And that is very representative of where the Democratic Party is right now. That is not something that Republicans are for, and overarchingly, that's not something that parents in general, no matter what side of the aisle, are for. And I think that we're seeing that play out in Virginia, where we have two very different candidates. We have one that's going to stand up for parents' rights. We have one who is not. And so I think, you know, just example after example, you're seeing here in this race that energy is on our side. People are excited. Our get out the vote efforts are incredibly strong, but we have a fantastic candidate, and that's certainly a race to watch. And as the election day gets closer, I think you'll continue to see really good things out of Virginia.
I think it's great, Rachel. I love your passion and your initiative. And I think that with that kind of approach, and with the support of the RNC, we may very well get two solid Republican governors in two extremely important states. You cannot overestimate the importance of Virginia. And for us in New Jersey to be able to flip New Jersey back to red, back to a Republican state, having a Republican executive, that would be momentous. That would be huge. So thank you for everything you're doing. And we're going to keep trying to do it from our end over here in the Delaware Valley. It was really good talking to you this morning.
Thank you, Christine.
That was Rachel Lee, Director of Communications for the Northeast Region for the RNC. And this is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle. We're going to take a break, and we will be back. This is Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer.
We are Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, because the truth never goes out of style.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers, sitting in for you know who, the great Chris DeGaulle. I'm here with Eddie. I'm here with Victoria. And I have a surprise guest that I was not sure that we would be able to talk to this morning, but I'm so thrilled that he is on the line. And that is another Jersey boy, a classic Jersey boy, the great Dan Cerucci. Hi, Danny. How are you?
How are you?
Good to see you. Pinch hit really, really well. I like texted you 3 minutes ago and you said, absolutely, I'm here. I wasn't sure the way that the show was going this morning, if we were going to, you know, what the time schedule was. But I definitely wanted to talk to you because you are my expert. Well, you're an expert in all things Jersey, as I said to Matt Rooney earlier in the show. But also, you're very big in the theater-going audience. And we just had the Tony.
The legitimate stage, as they call it.
The legitimate stage. Oh, yes. We sound like Chip and Dale, Dan. It's like, hey, very good. Hey, how are you? But you and Carol, your beautiful wife, Carol, attend a lot of Broadway shows, not just Broadway. I'm sure you've been to the McCarter Theater. Is that in Princeton, I think,
yes.
Or Mount Holly? That's a great, great yes, Jersey
in lovely Princeton. Yes, I've been there, of course.
Is your name Daniel Cerucci Hollingsworth III? Something like
actually, that. I'm E. Daniel Cerucci III, yes.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure what the E stands for, though, Christine.
His Excellency. His Excellency. This is a Gaethje. But we were talking earlier about the pretentiousness of the attendees at the Tonys and the Emmys, the most recent Emmy Awards. I know there was a huge controversy because there weren't any masked people at the Emmy Awards. And who was it? That guy, Seth, I forget his name. But he got up there and he was looking out at the audience and he said, I don't feel safe because there were no masked people. And right away they come back and say, well, everybody was vaccinated. So give us your take on these award shows.
Well, I want to address the Tonys because that was on just the other night. And I, as you say, I am a great fan of Broadway. I already have several tickets for the upcoming season. And in the case of the Tonys, which was held at the magnificent Winter Garden Theater, I've been there many times and seen many shows there, everybody in the audience was masked. And I thought that was really great. And you cannot get into a Broadway show unless you are vaccinated. And I'm expecting that that people will be masked. The audience will be masked. In fact, they mentioned that during the Tony telecast. But I love Broadway. I loved watching the show because it was basically a concert of some of the most wonderful entertainers singing great show tunes. Unfortunately, the people receiving awards find it necessary to give political speeches. And this has become common, as you know, on most of the awards shows. And, of course, God forbid that anybody should get up and say any kind of remark from, you know, the right side.
Yeah, I call it the Vanessa Redgrave syndrome.
Indeed, it goes all the way back to Vanessa Redgrave, which was quite a number of years ago. But when Vanessa Redgrave did it, I mean, she was excoriated. Okay, she almost lost her career. But now it's almost expected that you get up there and you make these political remarks, which are of course totally unnecessary. And one person said, got so carried away. I don't remember who it was. That this person said, what we do can change the world, will change the world. Well, you know, I've seen a lot of Broadway shows, and some of them are, you know, very significant and have had a profound effect on me. I'm not sure how much they really change the world. I think they sometimes can contribute to a change in attitude. Like the wonderful song, for example, from South Pacific, you've got to be carefully taught.
I knew you were going to say that. Oh, my goodness. Great minds think alike. I knew you were going to say that one. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, that changed the way a lot of people saw things, you know.
So did West Side Story, you know, the story of racial intolerance. I mean, that
yes,
was a
exactly.
beautiful, tragic story.
And I think that it helped to move things along. It helped to move, you know, racial progress, racial tolerance along. But
I don't think anybody said the next day, oh, my God, this show just changed the world. You know?
I know.
The whole world has changed now.
I think, you know, artists, God love them. Artists are artists. But they have a very high opinion of themselves and their impact on society. That's why I used to love Charles Barkley when he wasn't an artist. He was a sports figure. But he basically said, I'm not a role model. I'm a human being. I play sports. You know, I live my life, I do my best, but don't look to me as some kind of symbol for something. And I love that humility, you know, that ability to say, I'm not going to change your life, you know, do it for yourself.
Exactly. And of course, the great Bernadette Peters.
Adore her.
Who is also Italian-American, like us.
Yes,
the great
she
Bernadette
is.
Peters. She said, either at the Tonys or in an interview relating to it, she said, at this point in my life, as an artist and as a creative person, when I'm involved in a collaborative process, as I almost always am, my role is simply to get out of the way. I thought that was so humble and so interesting and insightful. In other words, that she's still learning from others.
Yeah.
So,
and she's won eight Tonys, by the way. She has eight Tonys. She has one of the people who has the most Tonys in the history of Tonydom, you know?
She's an absolutely amazing performer, and at 73, she stole the show. I mean, she looked absolutely incredible. And she is a very, very classy person.
She is. She really
and
is.
There are, you know, there are a lot of people like that on Broadway. You know, the performance by Audra McDonald and Brian Stokes Mitchell singing The Wheels of a Dream from the great musical Ragtime just stopped the show. It absolutely stopped the show.
I saw Audra McDonald
more,
in person.
Do you need any more evidence that Broadway is tolerant and welcoming than these two superstars, African-American superstars, absolutely stopping the show? Broadway is the most tolerant and welcoming artistic venue in America right now. They don't need, you don't need to lecture Broadway.
No, absolutely, absolutely not. I mean, you are so right. Throughout its history, really, I mean, I guess in a way, maybe I'm going to contradict myself in that of the four major, forms of entertainment, that being television,
right,
film, music, and theater, it has really been theater that has sort of broken barriers. And it, with respect to Audra McDonald, I agree with you 100%. She is brilliant. I saw her in Marie Christine at Lincoln Center maybe almost 20 years ago. And that voice and that presence and that grace and humility is just
right,
exceptional. And I would watch her on a television show. I believe she was on not Grey's Anatomy, the other one, the spinoff from Grey's Anatomy. And I looked at her, and her character was so kind of like circumscribed and limited and narrow. And I kept thinking to myself, this woman is a superstar. She should be singing right now. And it's just, she's transcendent. Rita Moreno, the same thing, the same type of classic.
Absolutely.
Cheetah Rivera.
Absolutely.
You know,
and these are Hispanic Broadway stars.
Yeah.
Who have been huge stars on Broadway for what, 40 years or more?
Yep.
I mean, they were welcomed into the Broadway community without hesitation decades ago.
And that's a great point. That's a great point, Dan, because these are older women who have had a very difficult time having longevity in film. But on Broadway, age doesn't matter. That's another barrier that's broken.
Exactly. And in the case of Cheetah Rivera, she's been starred in Broadway recently in the Candor and Ebb musical The Visit. This was only a few years ago. She's such a a regular on the Great White Way, as they say. It may be the Great White Way, but it's a lot of different colors in the people that are performing. And it's been that way for quite a while on Broadway. And it, I think it's a wonderful thing. And it you almost don't even have to think about it, because if you look at the Broadway star, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote and starred in the biggest hit on Broadway in God knows how long, Hamilton.
Yeah.
Here's a show that's going to run forever.
Which I have yet to see. I really want to see it. I haven't been able to get a ticket. So I guess I'll have to wait until the tricentennial of the Constitution to be able to get a ticket and actually see this show. But Danny, we're up against a clock. I'm just so happy that I got to hear your voice today, especially on our very Jersey-centric show. We've had a lot about Jersey. And by the way, Victoria's on the other end. She's a Jersey girl, and she was very happy to know that you are from Camden / Cherry Hill / All Points Jersey. So go Jersey and go Jack Chitterelli.
You know, there's a lot of very, very classy people from Camden, Christine.
Absolutely.
Quite the place.
Oh, my darling, I see them all the time on the high-speed line. Absolutely. Anyway, big hug and a kiss. Give my love to Carol, and I'll talk to you soon. That was the great, 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 great Dan Cerucci. We're going to take a break, and then when we come back, I'm going to talk to my friend Dan Bartowiak. Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great and greatly missed, as I said before, Chris DeGaulle. I am always happy, though, because I get a chance when Chris isn't here and I am, I get a chance to see Eddie. And I'm even more excited because I get a chance to see Victoria today, which much more rarely occurs. But, you know, it's always cool to see my girl.
So kind of you.
No, it's the truth. It totally be the truth. Anyway, and we've had such a great show. I've had friends on, people who I greatly admire, love talking to Emerald Robinson. And I'm going to continue that trend with a very good friend and someone who I greatly, greatly admire. And that would be my friend, Dan Bartowiak, the director of communications for the Pennsylvania Family Institute. The reason that I wanted Dan to come on this morning is to talk about the monumental, incredibly, profoundly moving success of the inaugural Pennsylvania March for Life. And before I bring Dan on, I want to read you a tweet from Governor Wolf, which in itself proves how effective this march was. This is from the governor in response to the march. "Today's March for Life in Harrisburg is just an anti-woman rally by a different name. They want to remove health care options during pregnancy, a time when so many already can't access life-saving care. I vetoed 3 anti-choice bills. I'll veto any others that come to me," end quote. And I can see him tweeting that out wearing his abortion clinic escort vest, holding it tight like a toddler would hold his teddy bear for comfort. Without further ado, hey, Dan, are you there?
I am. Good morning, Christine.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful to talk to you in the wake of such an amazing event. So you were there. Give us the rundown. What happened?
Oh, it was an incredible, amazing day. And I will say, you know, usually when it comes to pro-life issues, when we read a tweet from Governor Wolf, it's not giving you any joy. You know, someone that wants to essentially kill babies with Down syndrome, have late-term abortions. I mean, it's just so extreme. But I have to say, when I came back and someone told me what he tweeted, that brought me such a huge smile, because it told me that this was a resounding success, because you could not miss what was going on in the front steps of the Capitol. I've never seen more people at the front steps of the Capitol than what happened on Monday for the Pennsylvania March for Life. And it was, I mean, you had legislators saying that have been there for decades that have said, this is the biggest crowd I've ever seen. And it was just so amazing to see thousands and thousands of concerned, families, women, children of all ages that were there collectively to say we need to protect life. Unborn children are being killed by abortion. We need to end this. And it was just so amazing to see. I mean, just the flood of people that were around the Capitol. It was just, I'm still getting chills, really, seeing some of the pictures and just being up, you know, at the stage front, looking out at the crowd. It was just such a great day.
I was so proud of you and of everyone who was there. And honestly, believe me, if I didn't have to be in immigration court that morning, I would have been on an Amtrak train and out in Harrisburg because, you know, it saddened me to miss that sort of an event. That this is historic. And I loved, I mean, you pointed out to me a tweet that I think is extremely important. And I love it. Representative Jason Ordite had basically tweeted out that the majority of the crowd were women, were mothers and daughters and sisters, and women, the people that allegedly were being defended, advocated for, spoken for by our governor, Tom Wolf.
Absolutely. You know, everywhere I turned, there were women of all ages. I mean, I was trying to take pictures of all the different signs that were made, and literally every sign that had, you know, homemade. So often it was a teenager, a college student that was, you know, a woman that is speaking out for life. And so it was just great to see. Yeah, the majority of the speakers were women. The majority, I mean, again, thousands. We probably estimated at least 5,000 people were at the front steps of the Capitol. The majority were women. And so to say that this is an anti-women rally, I mean, it's just insane when you see so many women that were standing up for life. So it just was, again, outstanding to see. It was outstanding to see there were a ton of legislators that came out as well. That was one reason why it was a Monday. I mean, folks, we were hearing folks, oh, too bad this isn't a weekend, or I'm not able to, you know, get off work, whatnot. So there was a ton of support even around the state. But we did it on Monday, especially to connect with our elected officials as they're going into their jobs, into their, you know, sessions. And we had so many legislators come down, and we had risers on the stage. We didn't have enough room for legislators that were taking up so much space on the risers. I mean, so it was just phenomenal to see Senator Cornyn, Senator Ward, Speaker Cutler, I mean, all talking about how large the crowd was, talking about how life begins at conception. I mean, it was just phenomenal to see the support by legislators and the support by people from all over Pennsylvania coming together to say we support life.
Everything that you said. And I was talking to Eddie earlier in the show, and I said, you know, the key point here is that it wasn't just the rank and file Pennsylvanian. Of course, we are the ones who have been doing the heavy lifting on pro-life issues for decades. But finally, we're getting legislators who are willing to put their bodies on the line, put their voices out there, not wait to be asked questions, but to actually be proactive about it. And I think that the beauty of it is that it's almost a not self-perpetuating, but the more people that they see who support them, who support life, who support unborn life, the more encouraged they will be to be more proactive, focused, outspoken, not be shouted down by the so-called pro-choice, which is really just pro-abortion lobby in Harrisburg. And I love the fact that there were women there, that the majority were women, not because earlier in the show I was saying I'm not a feminist, but because it really reveals the lie that abortion is something that women support, or that it's something that, you know, you can only be a strong woman and you can only be respected if you support abortion rights. There are so many of us out here who have been speaking for years and years and years. And finally, people are taking notice that this is a human rights issue that crosses gender, but that women are in the forefront of defending unborn life. I love the photos that that Kathy Rapp put out there. I retweeted them because you look at that carpet of human beings in front of the Capitol. You can't buy PR like that. You can't. I mean, anyway, I'm going off track. I'm just so happy and so grateful for your role in this, and you and Michael Gear, everything that you guys have been doing to make this a possibility. So kudos to you.
Well, thank you. And a huge thank you goes out to everyone that came down. I mean, there were people on buses, some that left at 3 a.m. to be able to get to our rally and march. And so to have that display of support absolutely is such an encouragement to elected officials. And it makes a statement to really everyone. I mean, there are reporters there that, I mean, they come to rallies all the time. And, you know, you might have 20 people that are standing on the steps. And so I talked with a few reporters that were just shocked, really, to see so many people there. And so there's so many ripple effects that this will have that is just, again, such an encouragement to see the pro-life community coming together to support this. And so I just, again, say thank you. Anyone listening that was a part of this, even those watching live streams and sharing online, I mean, just a huge thank you to everyone who helped make this possible.
Yeah, and this is just the beginning, and this is just the first one. I can only imagine what it will be, you know, like in the coming years, because as you mentioned, there were a lot of teenagers there, you know, and you get them young, you know, it's like, what is it? They say the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. You get someone at a young age and you give them that appreciation for the sanctity and sacred nature of what women can do, give life, and you've got them for life. And so, I mean, my generation, sadly, is a lost generation. I am the generation that was very, very young when Roe versus Wade was, you know, became law. And I see so much apathy on the part of some of my, you know, contemporaries. And I really think that the future of the pro-life movement lies with young people. And they've got a lot of energy. And I love the fact that young women are at the forefront of the pro-life movement. And don't ever let anybody tell you that that's not correct and that the statistics don't bear that out. Generation life is growing, and it's going to continue to grow.
Absolutely.
Thank you for everything that you do, Dan. We're blessed to have your organization in this great Keystone State. And I hope I get a chance to talk to you again on air in the not too distant future.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And again, thanks so much for your support and everyone out there. We're going to continue to protect life here in Pennsylvania.
Yes, we are. That is my great friend, Dan Bartowiak of the Pennsylvania Family Institute. And this is Christine Flowers in for the equally great Chris DeGaulle. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back on Philadelphia's 990 AM, The Answer.
Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle. Download our free mobile app. Go to quicklinks at 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. For the last 97 seconds, this is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle. It's, as always, an honor, a joy, a pleasure. I want to thank Eddie, as always. I mean, he's been doing yeoman's work, and he will be with you tomorrow. I want to thank Victoria for just being just like amazing. And I want to thank all of you who have reached out to me on social media, who I know are listening. I really appreciate the fact that you wake up early enough to lend me your ears. What is it? Friends, Romans, countrymen, friends. Philadelphians, countrymen, lend me your ears at 6 o'clock in the morning. That's a lot. And I really appreciate the fact that you guys do that. We all hope and wish only the best for Chris. We want him to be back behind the microphone very soon, because even though I love being here, and even though Eddie loves being here, even though he's juggling 8,000 things, and Victoria is wonderful, as I said, this is Chris's microphone, and you know, we miss his voice. So get back here soon, Chris DeGaulle. We miss your voice. And I have to note that today, the 29th of September, is the feast day of my favorite kick-ass saint, Saint Michael the Archangel, the only saint that walks around with a spear. Take care. Talk to you soon. Christine Flowers in for Chris DeGaulle.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990.
The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.